Daddy, what's a podcast?
Well, son, a podcast is something you listen to because you want to listen to it, when you want to listen to it, not because some broadcast radio station says you have to tune in at a certain time. You can listen to it on your desktop computer. You can listen to it on your laptop computer. You can listen to it on your iPod, your iRiver, your iWhatever. But you listen to it because you want to listen to it, not because it's what happens to be on. That, my son, is what a podcast is.
You're listening to Snacks for the Brain.
Podcasting for you.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is Scott Merrick from the Vanderbilt University Center for Science Outreach, bringing you Snacks for the Brain, episode 39. This is the second of many bi-weekly Snacks for the Brain, which will be comprised of a wonderful interview with a scientist who's interested in connecting to K-12 students worldwide through the services of the Vanderbilt University Center for Science Outreach. It will include a tech tip tidbit so juicy, so tasty, you'll wonder why it's not fattening. And will also feature three PodSafe Music songs from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Speaking of which, let's start out this week's show with a rocker. Last week we started with a nice mellow jazz tune. Might put one of those in this week, who knows? But here's a rocker from Aerosol Halo called Bring Out the Hook.
To my head.
man, really, bring out the hook. That's Aerosol Halo from music.podshow.com, the PodSafe Music Network. Whoa! Hey, before we get into our interview this week, which I think you'll really enjoy, I'd like to share with you something I picked up off the counter at Fido here in Nashville, Tennessee. It's my favorite coffee house here. While I was waiting for my go order so I could come back and work on Snacks for the Brain, I picked up the business section from the Nashville, Tennessean this morning, which was laying there, and the headline article in the business section is entitled MD Shortage Forecast in the Near Future. So I'd like to quickly share that with you because I think it really speaks to what we're trying to do in our outreach efforts from the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach. Listen up to this article. From the Nashville, Tennessean business section, Tuesday, June 20, 2006. MD shortage forecast in near future. Med schools cite aging population, retiring physicians, by Todd Pack, Tennessean staff writer. Patients could have a tough time finding a doctor within a few years unless the nation's medical schools start producing a lot more physicians. That's according to the Association of American Medical Colleges, which said Monday that it wants to see enrollment grow 30% by 2015. If that doesn't happen, the demand for doctors may eventually outstrip the supply, the academic group said. A shortage of U.S. doctors would have a profound impact on all Americans, especially baby boomers, that generation born between 1946 and 1964, said Dr. Jordan Cohen, the group's president. The baby boom generation is now reaching 60, and in another decade they'll be reaching 70, said Edward Salzberg, director of the AAMC's Center for Workforce Studies. Last year, the AAMC called for 15% growth in enrollment, but on Monday, the group said it had taken a fresh look at the problem and decided a 15% increase wouldn't be enough to avoid a shortage. It's calling for larger class sizes at existing schools, as well as the creation of new medical schools. Given the extensive time it takes to educate and train tomorrow's doctors, efforts to increase enrollment must get underway as soon as possible, Cohen said. If the nation's medical schools were to follow the group's recommendation, the result would be 5,000 more graduates every year to replace retiring physicians and care for a growing, aging population. Generally, people require more medical care as they age, but an aging population is only one of the factors likely to lead to a physician shortage, the AAMC said. One-third of doctors practicing today are older than 55 and will probably retire by 2000, the group said. Compounding the problem is that younger doctors may be less inclined to work the same hours as many older doctors, the group said. Doctors in medical school today will be more likely to look for ways to balance work and family than those of a generation ago, said Dr. Bonnie Miller, Vanderbilt University's Associate Dean for Undergraduate Medical Education. As a result, it may take two doctors in the future to handle the same workload as one doctor in the past, she said. But increasing enrollment as much as the AAMC wants won't be easy, Miller said. Vanderbilt has about 105 first-year medical students and is looking into whether it can accommodate 110, but adding more than that would mean hiring additional faculty and expanding lab and classroom space, she said. Vanderbilt is Tennessee's second-largest medical school, with 436 students enrolled last fall, according to the AAMC. Officials from Meharry Medical College in Nashville couldn't be reached for comment, but Ron Franks, dean of East Tennessee State University's Quillen College of Medicine, said the Johnson City School is considering a plan to eventually increase the size of its first-year class to as many as 74 students, up from 60. The biggest concern we have is making sure there are enough patients in pediatrics and obstetrics, Franks said. Being in a relatively smaller community, we have to make sure we don't compromise the education of our students. East Tennessee may increase the size of its first-year class by 4 to 6 students in 2007, he said. Likewise, Dr. Herschel Wall, the interim dean of the University of Tennessee's medical school, said, "I think it's inevitable that we will increase enrollment." Wall, who is also the associate dean for admissions and student affairs, said the university decided several years ago to reduce the size of its first-year class from 165 to 150 because officials thought it would improve the quality of instruction without hurting the quality of care in the state. UT is the state's largest medical school, with 618 students last fall. Given the aging population, he said, the school has little choice but to look for ways to train more doctors. I think this is going to require thoughtful planning, Wall said. Wall said he wasn't sure how many students UT would be able to add to its first-year class or when, but he said following the AAMC's recommendations would be difficult. I can't speak for any other school, he said, but I suspect most schools can't easily jump 30%. Todd Pack covers the business of healthcare. He can be reached at tpack@tennessean.com or 615-259-8075. All right, sir, there's the article from the Tennessean this morning. I hope you realize that I'm sharing it with you to help drive home the point that if you're an educator or a parent, helping to drive your children toward careers in medical sciences and research sciences is something well worth doing and important for the future of the future.
Huh? What do you
say? I know I'm holding you off a little bit more, but I do want to share another wonderful song by one of my very favorite PodSafe music artists, independent artists. Her name is Happy Rhodes. And I found her at the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. She has her own website, and I'll link to that in the show notes this week so that perhaps you can go visit her website. She's really an unusual, interesting songwriter and performer. We're going to slow things down here with a lovely, lovely song by her from her Equipoise CD called Mother Sea.
Little building, okay.
Happy Roads from music.podshow.com. Please check her out from the link in our show notes at snacksforthebrain.blogspot.com. Alrighty then, it's time for the interview. I interviewed this week not a scientist per se, but a man who writes about science and who is quite experienced in doing so. David Salisbury is Associate Director for Science and Research Communications at Vanderbilt University. I got together with him in his office today and had a wonderful little chat, largely centered around his fantastic website called Exploration. Find that website in the show notes and go and spend, well, you better allocate an hour or two for your first visit because it's really, really good. For your edification, a discussion with David Salisbury. Coming up next.
You're listening to Snacks for the Brain.
So, I guess what we want to talk about today, I'm here with David Salisbury.
Salisbury,
Who is the
Associate Director of Science and Research Communications
at Vanderbilt University.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? What do you do?
Well, in most universities, the science communications function is part of the overall news service, their public information office at the university. There are a few universities, and Vanderbilt is one, who decided that science communication was unique enough so that it required a little different organization. And so they've broken out off the science communications from the other aspects of news service of their, you know, media relations efforts to, you know, allows me to do some more things than, you know, I could do, like when I was at Stanford, for instance, and I was a member of the news service there.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't special. Was it specialized science at Stanford?
Well, I was specialized science at Stanford.
You have quite a background in publishing, and I was checking out your Vanderbilt profile on your page, and you've done a lot of publishing. You've written for New York Times and Scientific American.
My first job and my journalism job was doing science writing for the Christian Science Monitor.
Correct, yeah.
Which I did more than 10 years. And while I was doing that, I also did freelance for some other publications, mm-hmm. you know, magazines mainly, some book reviews for the New York Times, a few other things like that. I've done a little bit of freelance stuff since I moved over from the journalism world to the university science communications world as well, not as much as I used to do.
Right. Well, you've got one foot sort of firmly in the journalism world, though, still, right? That part of your expertise as a communicator.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that's happening because of the web, you know, and the internet, is that universities and other institutions of science now have an opportunity to tell their story directly to the public without having to go through the media gatekeepers. One of the things that was has been an ongoing frustration for me, and I think for my colleagues at a number of other universities, is that public opinion poll after public opinion poll, you know, indicates that there is a significant interest and desire on the part of the public for information about scientific and medical research. Yet the conventional media, with a few exceptions, has tended to relegate that to give that as about as much space as they give, you know, astrology columns or, you know, other kind of lifestyle things.
Right.
And for some reason, they don't believe their own polling about the extent of interest that the public has in this. And part of the problem is that they haven't been able to figure out how to sell to support it.
And it boils down to the mighty dollar,
to a large extent. So, beginning about, 15 years ago or so, it seemed to me that the internet was really where the future of science communications lies, and it's an entirely new medium. with its own characteristics, its own properties, and so forth. I really wanted to get involved in figuring out how to use that to tell more effective stories about the value and the significance and the excitement of basic research.
What you're doing really primarily now here at Vanderbilt, too, is working with the Exploration website, which I've looked at and haven't looked at extensively enough. Plan to do so more, and certainly we'll link to that site in my show notes page for this podcast. So if you're listening to this and haven't visited snacksforthebrain.blogspot.com, please do that, because there will be some links, one of which will be to the Exploration site, which was created by you and is maintained by you.
Yeah.
Very sexy site, web geeky speaking. It's very, very attractive site. And interesting to navigate.
Yeah, well, I guess the basic premise of the site is that an awful lot of scientific research is fundamentally graphic in nature. It's dynamic in nature. So trying to translate that all into text is, to a certain extent, an unnatural act. You know, some people are very good at it, but it's really tough. And for a lot of research, you know, if you can see pictures of it, if you can see movies of how, you know, something works, like how a robot works, or
technology malfunction warning.
We had a little Dell Axum Pocket PC X50V malfunction during the interview. Luckily, we didn't miss very much. I guess rather than a technology malfunction, you might consider it an operator malfunction. Since I'd been out running around in the world the past couple of days doing some found sound work for future podcasts. Oh, here's an example. Listen to this 1 minute found sound and see if you can guess what it is.
Did you guess it? Did you guess it? Did you guess it?
That was a train starting up from a dead stop. Back to the interview. David Salisbury.
You're listening to Snacks for the Brain.
Pop back on there. technology. Yeah, I got 547 seconds in that last recording, which is probably most of what we did.
Yeah.
I shared an article from the Tennessean today about the coming shortage of medical doctors.
Wow.
In the nation. It was in the business section yesterday morning in the Tennessean. It was a headline article about how, you know, by 2015 we're in deep trouble for the population of medical doctors because they're all going to be retiring. Mm-hmm. And there's not a significant force coming in behind them to replace them and, in fact, deal with the increased numbers that we'll need. Partly also because they mentioned in the article, which I found interesting, that doctors in the future and already in the present are choosing a lifestyle a little less work intensive than the traditional medical doctor lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to need more doctors for even the same number of populations. So it's wild. We should be all about motivating the kids and educating the kids. And if they have a predilection for a scientific career, by all means to pursue it.
But from what I've heard, though, like here at Vanderbilt, 45 or 50% of the students who come in intending to go into pre-med or something like that. So I think there's a lot of interest. But when they actually get in the program and start going through organic chemistry and other,
calculus that nearly knocked me out of school.
Things like that. Well, then the numbers drop off. The people drop out pretty substantially.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what that means in terms of kind of recruitment.
Well, if people of your nature can take advantage of the new media literacy that kids are, in fact, everybody's is asking for that. Everybody needs that. It's not just text. It's not just audio. I hate to admit that, but it's not. And your website does just a fine job of showing and telling. So where's it going, the exploration website?
Well, we just last year spent actually kind of more than a year doing a redesign on the site. And the redesign was from a fairly standard HTML design site, with each page had to be custom coded and all that stuff.
You do all the coding?
No.
He says with a smile.
No, I have contractors who do that for me.
That's great. I need some of those.
Yeah. Anyway, so to the current site, which is very flash intensive, my feeling was that our previous site was still a little bit too text intensive. I felt that we really needed to have a different balance between the visuals and the text. The visuals needed to be a bit stronger than they were. My goal was to kind of create an online environment where the text and the photos and the animations and the illustrations and the video would all work together. And so we created this site where essentially it starts out with an idea I came up with, which was having a story map, which is like a flow chart for each story that you can navigate, use for navigation, and you can go around and you can go through the story any way that you want. Anyway, so the story map, which is a visual navigation aid that allows you to go through the story and to keep track of where you've been. And then on the individual pages, the text is down in a clean kind of column, and then there are fairly large thumbnails for each of the multimedia elements in the left column. So that's, they're sort of organized to retain an association between the text and then the different multimedia.
It's a beautiful site.
Elements. And then when you click on the multimedia elements, whether it's a photo, illustration, or what, then it pops up in a viewer pane, which you can move around and place anywhere on the screen. You can open it up or close it down to what size you want. And you can open as many of these different multimedia objects in a given story.
Very cool. I think this would be a really useful site for use in classrooms. You know, one of the big things I see happening in schools these days is the LCD projectors going into classrooms.
Yeah.
We have an initiative at university school that's starting with the fourth grade in the lower school, also putting quite a few in the high school, hopefully having taught in a computer laboratory with an LCD projector. It's just, there's no substitution for that. And this website would be a handy something for the teachers of science at all levels to use.
We're in the process of trying to put together kind of a marketing plan for exploration. And one of the things we would like to do is to get the word out more, you know, to science teachers in the state and around the country.
Yeah. I guess the only thing we can do as a group is me help you, and hopefully you help us, and we use as many different modalities as we can, sort of a mini model of your website.
Yeah. Now, Jan Zanita said, I remember several years ago telling me that Tennessee had a state science curriculum.
There is.
And that listed aids for different sections and things like that. And so I always wondered if there's some way that we could have gotten exploration listed in that.
I'm sure there is. I mean, maybe one way to go about it would be to get a worker for you to get a hold of that science curriculum, correlate the website facets with particular elements, and then hand that to them on a platter. You know? Having dealt with government bureaucracies, and education is certainly not a lot different from other government bureaucracies.
No, you've got to do a lot of impedance matching.
That's a really nice way to describe it. So is your background web design too?
No, my background's physics and science writing.
Yeah, see, I'm a total dilettante when it comes to science. My background is poetry and mandolin. But I really have found that interviewing scientists and people interested in science education is just a fascinating thing. It's never boring.
I had a colleague of mine once describe the occupation of science writer as a terminal occupation, because once people get hooked on it, they don't want to do anything else. And that's one of the problems that, one of the things that's held back science reporting in some ways in traditional newspapers and so forth is that the science writers don't want to go on to be the managing editors and the editors and make decisions about the layout, the home page, the front pages and stuff like that,
right.
And make decisions about...
They want to write about science.
They want to write about science. And so it's the, you know, it's the political wonks, you know, are the ones who go on to take control of the, that have editorial control of the newspapers, and the people who are really, really into politics don't seem, that seems to be kind of antithetical
mm-hmm.
With a real deep interest in science.
Warning, terminal technology malfunction alert.
Well, the Dale Axum sort of died again toward the end of our conversation, and so we didn't get really a suitable closer with David. But I do want to thank you, David Salisbury, for a marvelous conversation, and I hope to get back together with you in the future to have another discussion centered around some of the amazing things you've covered as a science writer. Jupiter flybys, the Viking mission to Mars, Three Mile Island. Please visit his website at www.vanderbilt.edu/exploration.
Standard spelling.
Any of you students out there interested in writing about science, there's a wonderful undergraduate degree program on science communications at Vanderbilt University. Well, everybody.
Tidbit time for Tech Tip Tidbit.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's a Tech Tip Tidbit. This one from completelyfreesoftware.com and Dr. T at rtemlak4dds@aol.com.
Question. I've heard you talk about turning off computers every night for safety and to save electricity, but what about printers? Do those need to be turned off as well?
Answer. It basically comes down to how much you're going to be printing. Most people usually use their computers off and on all day, so they leave them on all day and then just turn them off at night to save some power and also for safety reasons. So, you can use the same rules for your printer. If you're going to be printing off and on all day, you might as well just keep the printer on or until you're completely finished. If you're just going to print one item and then not print for a few hours, turn it off. The two reasons that go around this are 1. Electricity usage and 2. Ink cartridge printheads drying out. The bigger issue here may be the drying of the printheads because printers don't really use that much electricity. The newer ones use even less, but older printers don't really use that much either. Most ink cartridges have some sort of capping mechanism that saves the head from any outside air that may come through when the printer is turned off. If you leave the printer turned on all day when you're not using it, you're just setting yourself up to have to buy another cartridge much sooner than you would normally have to. If your printheads dry up, your printing quality will be poor as well. Make sure you always turn your printer off by the on-off button and not by flipping your power strip device. When you use the on-off button, the capping mechanism that I mentioned above will fully engage and do its job correctly. Otherwise, it won't, and your cartridge will still be at risk for drying out. The source is worldstart.com, and again, that's from Dr. T at completelyfreesoftware.com.
Nanny, nanny, boo, boo, listen when you want to.
That's it, ladies and jelly beans, for Snacks for the Brain, episode number 39. I hope you'll join us again in a couple weeks for episode number 40. Wow, can you believe it? 40 whole episodes of Snacks for the Brain. It's a wonder I'm not
outgrowing all my clothes.
Hey, I'd like to close things out today with a wonderful track from a local boy made good. His name is Joe Turley. I discovered Turley's music at GarageBand.com.
And so can you.
He's got all sorts of session musicians in his big band, and I think you'll be able to hear that if you just listen up to this track. This is called Like I Do. See ya!
See ya!
Nobody loves you like I do, like I do. Nobody needs you like I do. Nobody wants you like I do, like I do. Nobody loves you like I do. You could go off searching all around.
like I do, like I do, like I do, like I do, like I do.
For the Brain is brought to you by the fine folks at Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, connecting working research scientists with K-12 students worldwide. Check out the website at www.vanderbilt.edu/CSO.